forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast. My guest is Jonathan R. Latham. He's an executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project. We're going to talk about the lab leak theory as is related to COVID and how that, you know, been changing over time, the narrative around it, the evidence supporting it. So welcome, Jonathan. Thanks for coming.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with a little bit of a background on yourself, and then we'll continue on to your lab leak theory.
Yeah, sure. So I am the executive director of the Bioscience Resource Project. I'm also the editor of a website called Independent Science News, and I'm also a virologist by training. So I worked in, I was a virologist and I worked on RNA biology, and that was my last position in academia.
Were you able to exit with tenure or with retirement, or would they kick you out, or what happened?
No, I left as a postdoc. I just quit.
Okay. Is it okay to ask why? Like, what was happening that caused you to do that?
There was a bunch of reasons. I mean, it was one and a half family reasons, but the other half was I had plenty of ethical problems with the academic choices that I was faced with. You know, I'd been doing the virology that I was doing for my PhD. You know, I gradually came to realize that this wasn't really being done for farmers. It was being done for the plant breeding industry. And the plant breeding industry didn't really need help. The people who needed help were the consumers and the farmers. So I felt I was supporting the wrong side, if you like. So, and then I worked in the RNA biology I did was basically medical research. I was working on C. elegans, the model organism worm. And it felt like the same thing. We were doing research that we didn't fully believe in, basically for the benefit of the pharmaceutical industry. And if the consumer, the public benefited, it was just going to be by luck. You know, it was not the intention of what we were doing. So it really felt, you know, science was being done backwards in a way to me. And so I kind of lost interest in it.
So what was the first thing you did? Did you start your website and publication of Independent Science?
Now, that took a while. You know, we went to work and we had a child. So that was kind of all-consuming thing a little bit. And that was, family was our priority. But then, you know, I got asked to give, people found out that I'd done genetic engineering, and I got asked to give talks in England about the meaning and risks and so forth of genetic engineering. So I went to a lot of public events that I was asked to go to. And at the time, there was this thing called the farm scale evaluations, which are still the biggest agricultural experiment ever done. But it was basically, the idea was to take hundreds of fields and grow GMO crops on one side and conventional agriculture on the other, and see which one benefited the environment. And it turned out that the very obvious answer was that conventional agriculture was much better for the birds, butterflies, weeds, whatever natural organisms were in those fields. And so it was kind of the defining moment in the history of GMOs in Europe. You know, when people realize that if you make herbicide-tolerant crop, then farmers are going to spray more herbicides and they're going to basically have clean fields, which were never possible before. But then you don't have the biodiversity that goes along with that we rely on.
Okay. How did you first interact with COVID? You know, we'll move on to the lab leak theory. What was your first interactions with that, and what's that been like over the past 4 years?
Yeah, to start with, I sat on the sidelines. You know, I didn't really want, I wasn't doing virology. I didn't want to think about all the origin issues or any other aspect of it. And I'm not an immunologist or anything, so I have no specialism in vaccine safety or vaccine effectiveness or whatever. So I didn't feel I had a contribution to make. But then a lot of people sent me information about the, you know, the possible lab escape of the SARS-2 virus. And so, you know, people kept sending me more and more information. And I started to realize that a lot of interesting coronavirus research including collecting coronaviruses from bats, was going on in Wuhan, and the coincidence seemed too difficult to ignore. And so I was kind of, in a sense, sucked into it, but I did make a conscious decision that this is something I can actually be useful doing.
Okay, so what did you start to find out about COVID? Theory and everything.
What happened at the beginning was, you know, we established the basics that the virus really started in Wuhan and probably not somewhere else, which was an open question at the beginning. We also established more in more detail the kind of research that was going on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So they were basically collecting bat viruses from the wild and mixing and matching them. And later it turned out that they had projects to make furin cleavage sites. And, you know, they, you could put more and more flesh on the bones of what they were thinking about doing. And essentially it was, you know, their project, in a sense, was to make a human adapted coronavirus. Not because they wanted to make one, but because they wanted to prove that these bat viruses were potential spillover type viruses and were a danger to the human population. So we also established that the virus was very suspiciously human adapted. You know, this is a really, it was a big thing for many people, was that if it's not probable that a bat virus that infects the GI tract is going to be adapted to the human respiratory system. There's a lot of leaps involved in that. And so when it was, you know, realized that the virus was not evolving much at all in the human population, then that becomes a huge red flag for the idea that this was somehow a pre-adapted virus and that somebody or somehow this virus was not simply a jump from a zoonotic intermediate. And then the other issue, of course, was that there was no apparent zoonotic intermediate. The Hunan seafood market, plausible.
That's what I was going to ask you. You know, you pushed that narrative that it was the wet market and it was in pangolins and all this BS. Did they just never update from that point? Do most people still think it came from the wet market? Like, it seems like it's just radio silence after.
Yeah, I mean, there was in 2022 and 2023, a few papers were published basically trying to make the case for the market, but none of them are very convincing. One of them argued that the virus that was found in the market was an ancestral form of the virus. Another one argued that there were two spillovers at the market and tried to divide the epidemic into basically what they called lineage A and lineage B. So there was another, you know, going back to what are the red flags for a lab outbreak, one of those huge red flags for a lab outbreak is a single spillover event, right? So if you imagine that some raccoon dog or something adapted virus is spreading on farms or and basically being in contact with wildlife handlers or with farmers or market stall holders, you expect multiple spillovers, right? That's what happened with SARS-1. There were a whole bunch of different spillovers by basically different viruses, and they all had slightly different properties and could be distinguished based on their sequence. And that wasn't the case for SARS-2, right? The difference between, you know, basically all the origin viruses can be traced back to a single individual. And so single genotype. So you have that. And so what certain group of researchers tried to do, and they published this in Science magazine, it was trying to show that there were actually two lineages. And the way that they did this is basically to argue that the virus's genome, so an intermediate between the two lineages, were in fact artifacts. They were basically sequencing errors. But to me, that was very, very dodgy argument to make. I mean, you have hundreds of different viruses that match the kind that are these intermediates. And if you go and look, you know, what they did was they basically set a very narrow window of the viruses they were going to sample. And you can only get a two lineage answer if you set that narrow window and you do make all these tweaks to your what you're prepared to consider as a valid outbreak virus and so forth. And basically these arguments are cherry picking is what's going on. And so, you know, on the one hand, you've got people putting forward a very implausible hypothesis, and then you've got the fact that this hypothesis is so implausible that you don't actually believe it, and so you realize that there is really only one spillover, that it probably didn't start at the Hunan market. So you add all these things together, and the case becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. And so now we're at the point where, you know, the evidence really against the zoonosis, and we'll go into this a little bit today, I hope, is so strong that is really very difficult to sustain.
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on Support Us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click Support Us today. Now back to the show.
We'll get into that in a minute, the detail, but how is it being treated in the wider news, mainstream media, and by various governments? Are they just ignoring this in the lab? Like, what's the state of the narrative now?
Well, the media is basically ignoring the evidence. What's happened on Twitter is, for example, is that a lot of, you know, which obviously is not the same thing as the New York Times or the Washington Post, but essentially the people who've been arguing for a zoonotic origin basically all left the discussion. So they are basically not defending it anymore. And I think they've realized that there just is not the arguments are not there, that in order to defend it, they basically have to make idiots of themselves. And so they basically all left Twitter because, you know, even though the people on Twitter are for the most part not that versed in virology and so forth, the arguments being put forward by the virologists who were on Twitter are so shoddy that they've had difficulty defending them. Then when it comes to the governments have basically turned a blind eye to what's happened. I mean, there was a report the other day that the US Secret Services had informed the British government that they thought that the virus was a lab leak. This is several years back now. But the British government basically said that, you know, they went to Jeremy Farrar and said their top virologist, and the top virologist said, oh, this isn't a lab leak. And so they sided with the virologist, who obviously that's not necessarily a smart choice because these people are conflicted. And these people have already been shown to be arguing, to be making bogus arguments, to be lying in public and saying different things in private to what they think in public and so forth. So the British government's decision to side with those people is rather, it's simply a political thing. It's like basically trying to not make waves and not upset the big pharma industry, you know, who are on the hook in a sense for some of this lab leak possibility, right? Because the question is, what were they doing in Wuhan that led to an escaped virus, right? Were they doing some kind of pharma type work, or are they doing pure virology, or were they doing even some kind of bioweapon work? Like, who's going to take the responsibility? Like, you know, in Wuhan, the responsibility question is quite open. There are a lot of people potentially on the hook. You know, the work was being funded in part by the U.S. Part of it was funded by USAID. There were all kinds of American and European interests. There was French, the Wuhan Institute of Virology's BSL-4 lab, brand new BSL-4 lab, was built by the French, for example. There are a lot of other people beyond Chinese virologists and all the CCP, if you like, who are potentially on the hook. So it's much easier for a government to basically say, we don't want to deal with any of this. You know, we're just going to pretend that it's a zoonosis.
Based on all the information you've gathered and seen over time, tell me the story of where COVID came from and how it got out.
Well, I mean, we have our own theory, which is that the virus, basically, it starts in 2012. I would say our theory is a minority theory, but to me as a virologist, it's by far the strongest theory, because we will discuss some of the specifics later. But, you know, the alternative, there are two basically lab leak narratives. So one is that viruses were collected from the wild. They were maybe mixed and matched with each other, and researchers added a furin cleavage site, and that made these viruses human adapted. And then that jumped out because they put it into a macaque or a mouse or something, and we're doing some pathology experiments, for example. So that's one theory. And the problem with that theory is that there is the issue, which is what I was discussing in our latest article, that it looks like COVID evolved. It wasn't simply cut and pasted. And there's very strong evidence for that now. And there's even more than what that I knew about when I wrote that article. So we can go into that too. So there is the most popular lab leak theory is that one, right? Some variant of that, you know, cutting and pasting, some pathologizing, we don't really know.
Well, I can tell you, early on, I found a paper from UNC Chapel Hill said they took a SARS-CoV backbone and they added various functional groups and they did gain-of-function research. It's right there in the scientific paper.
Absolutely.
So this method of gain-of-function and doing exactly what you're talking about, that was a paper from, I don't remember what, it was at least 15, 20 years ago. But this has been going on for a long time.
So, you know, there's more and more of that kind of research using exactly the kind of viruses that SARS-2 is descended from. So, yeah, initially to us, that was the strongest candidate, really. And, you know, but it was still a good thing for us for a long time. But we made some breakthroughs of our own. So what happened was that somebody found a master's thesis that was the doctor's report of a outbreak of a suspected coronavirus in Yunnan, southern China, in 2012. Now, this outbreak infected 6 miners who were shoveling back guano. So there's a link right there to that. So then, according to the master's thesis, which we had translated from Chinese, so we downloaded a copy and translated it from Chinese, and in there is a description of how 6 miners became sick. 3 of them died. And the doctors decided that the likely explanation for that illness was a novel coronavirus, deriving from the mine shaft where they were shoveling the back guano. And when you look at that thesis, what you realize is that those miners had symptoms of the look like COVID, right? And so this really piqued our interest. And so we started to think about how there could be a link between this mine outbreak and the beginning of COVID in 2019.
And how many hundreds of kilometers away was the mine from Wuhan?
The mine is about 1,500 kilometers from Wuhan. But the mine happens to sit in exactly the phylogeographic epicenter of where SARS-2 is supposed to have come from, right? The wild relatives of SARS-2 all come from the region around the mine, southern Yunnan and northern Laos. So this is something we didn't know at the time. What we did know at the time is that at what was then the most closely related virus was isolated from that mine shortly afterwards by the Wuhan Institute of Virology, right? So there's a link between the phylogeographic location of the mine and SARS-2, right? So this is a very important fact on the ground. The second thing is that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was taking biological samples from those miners, right? They were basically sampling the blood of the miners at regular intervals and taking those samples back to Wuhan. The second thing that we know is that the Wuhan Institute of Virology did an investigation of this outbreak, and they reported it in a Nature paper. And what they basically did was they claim to have tested the blood from these miners and done basically a set of very superficial investigations and then concluded that these miners did not have coronavirus. But there are 3 different sources who say that the samples collected from the miners by the Wuhan Institute of Virology, that they did test positive for a coronavirus. Right, a novel coronavirus. So George Gao, who's the head of the Chinese CDC, plus a student who went to the mine, plus the master's thesis, they all say that the Wuhan Institute of Virology's tests for a coronavirus were positive, right? So we're faced with the likelihood that the WIV is lying about what they found inside those miners. And it's very interesting that even though this Mayan outbreak was considered a big deal in China at the time, there are a lot of references to it in Chinese documents and so forth. The Wuhan Institute of Virology, even though they sequenced a bat virus from that Mayan that was collected just after the miners got sick, have never made any reference to the Mayan outbreak. Right. So when RATG-13, the most closely related virus to SARS-2, was first found and published by the Wuhan Institute of Virology, they made no mention of this outbreak. Right. And the whole reason why they collected the virus was because of the outbreak. Yes.
Is there any appetite at all for the truth that you've seen or you're able to find, you know, extremely compelling evidence? Do you think anyone will do anything about it? I don't know.
There's no appetite for the truth that I can see. I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, even people who are amenable to the idea of a lab leak, many of them are in the game because they have some kind of beef with China or the CCP, right? So they have, you know, some of them are from Taiwan, for example. You know, they're not necessarily anti-Chinese, but they hate the CCP. So you've got people who would like there to be some kind of malfeasance on the part of China or the WIV, and that such that an accident is, doesn't really meet their need, right? And then you've got virologists who are absolutely loath to have even the superficial discussion of the zoonosis, because they know that facts around the zoonosis do not stack up, right? The more you look at the data, the less plausible it is that this is a zoonosis. And as every fact comes out, it makes the zoonosis look less and less likely. Their interest in discussing the facts on the ground becomes less and less. So what you see in the scientific literature is negligible discussion of the zoonosis, right? And the negligible discussion of the zoonosis is basically because the facts don't stack up. And so any discussion of it is going to be an embarrassment. And so the next best strategy is silence.
Yeah, I mean, I would guess that NIH went on a tear and was funding all kinds of COVID stuff, but our best buddy Fauci, you know, holds the purse strings there. So any NIH-funded papers are never going to mention what they don't want mentioned. So I would guess we're not going to see anything in the literature.
I mean, I went to a virology conference a couple of weeks ago in Hanover, Germany, and I spoke to a woman who worked at the NIH, and she works at HIV, and she said, I've got a, you know, I offered to give a talk at the NIH about the origin of COVID. And so she did her research. She came to the conclusion that it's probably a lab leak. Then she gave her presentation at the Institute, and I asked her, what was the reception that you got, right?
Did she mysteriously commit suicide a day later?
No,
even though she claimed she had COVID or whatever.
No, she just said to me in this good human way, she said, it's the NIH. Nobody said anything. So, like, you know, they're not interested in finding out the truth because the truth is going to be embarrassing. You know, they can't show a zoonosis. Zoonosis looks more and more unlikely.
It may be more than embarrassing. It may be more than that.
Yeah, of course.
It's more. That's like lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit after lawsuit after criminal liability. NIH stands for nobody is interested in helping. Maybe that's what the acronym means.
Did you make that up?
Yeah, I just made it up.
Yeah, but I mean, in this case, it's extraordinarily true. You know, the NIH, I mean, it's not widely understood that the NIH really tries to steer research, you know, and so that is their MO, to try to steer research in favor of some things and against others. And my, you know, my assumption about the NIH is they do a lot of research that they don't publish. There's a lot of questions out there in the literature which are not being answered in the literature that are very obvious questions. Like, what is the function of coronavirus spikes in bats, right? From the closely related viruses. If you know what the starting point was, then you have all kinds of handles on what the process of the evolutionary origin might have been. But no one is doing that research. You'll find that there's a group in France. There's a tiny bit of research from Japan that I was hearing at the Hanover meeting. And there is also Ralph Barrick. The safe hands of Ralph Barrick is doing a little bit of research on these ancestral viruses. But you would have thought that that would be an extraordinarily interesting question, but no one wants to know the answer to it.
Well, as a virologist, have you been able to look at supposedly what the sequences, and I don't know what they call it on a virus, you know, on the RNA strand, the functional groups, I don't know if that's the term, but the, you know, the different clusters of, you know, of RNA fragments that could code for various things. I don't know what they call each, like GAG and LOL and POL. And
that's HIV. Have we been able to look at them? I mean, on a computer screen, sequence.
Yeah, have you had a sequence that you believe is actually reliable? And what did you see?
I do not think that any of the virus sequences have ever been faked. I've never seen any. A lot of people have alleged this on Twitter and said that these viruses are, you know, have been manipulated. But I don't think that there's any good evidence for that. You know, there's some evidence of not enough coverage over certain parts of the genome, the RAP G13 and so forth. But, you know, there is no, I mean, we now have the whole genome sequences of probably 15 viruses that are very closely related to SARS-2. And you can make a perfectly reasonable phylogeny out of those. And you can show that some recombine with others to make different parts and so forth. And if you know, in principle, those phylogenies would disprove anybody who was messing about in any significant way with the genomes that were being presented. Now, I don't think that all the genomes that are known have ever been put out into the scientific literature or put onto GISAID or GenBank or wherever. I think there are people hiding sequences, that's for sure. But I don't think that any of the sequences out there are fake. And we treat them all in our analysis as 100% valid.
Yeah, but what can you tell by looking at the sequences? Does this look man-altered, or there's a very plausible explanation that it could have evolved by passaging from other similar forms?
Yeah, you can tell a lot. I mean, I wouldn't say that you can tell everything. I mean, you've got, on the one hand, you've got, you know, each SARS genome, SARS baculovirus genome, is like 30,000 nucleotides long. So there's a lot of non-synonymous changes between all these viruses. Then there are synonymous changes. So that's on the big scale. On the small scale, you're asking me questions like, was the furin cleavage site, which is 12 nucleotides long, added by a person or added through evolution? Right, that would be a simple version of what you're asking. Would that be right?
Let's say that again about the furin cleavage site.
The micro version of your question is, the furin cleavage site that was added is only 12 nucleotides long. It's four amino acids, right? PRRA that was added to SARS that basically defines the difference. It's the biggest nucleotide change in the spike protein. It has been shown to be instrumental in leap from a GI tract lifestyle to a lung infection life history. So you're asking me, can we say for sure that 12 nucleotides was or was not added by a person?
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess it would depend upon the likelihood of that appearing.
Yeah.
You know, without being a little bit engineered. That's what I was saying. Is like, you're a virologist.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the probability that this is made?
Yeah. So there are a lot of ways to approach this question, right? So, you know, you can think about it as this is a very small sequence. It's hardly likely to be definitive. But what's really interesting is that if you look at how researchers, for example, have altered, a lot of research has been done that add furin cleavage sites to viruses. And in the case of coronaviruses, it's been done multiple times, including by Ralph Baric and Zhengli Shi to different viruses. So you can look at the history of adding furin cleavage sites, for example, to viruses. And what you find is that when researchers add furin cleavage sites, there are important differences between the way that the furin cleavage site was added to all these viruses versus the way it was done with SARS-2, right? The difference between SARS-2 and its most recent ancestors doesn't match the alterations that researchers typically make. So firstly, researchers normally make substitutions. To make a furin cleavage site, you introduce substitutions. You don't add four amino acids, right? Because adding four amino acids will change the structure of the protein, so far as you know, and introduce basically unnecessary level of change. If you want to just simply do a scientific experiment, then you make substitutions. And SARS, the furin cleavage site of SARS-2 is not a substitution. It's a four amino acid insertion. So that's one difference. The other difference is that the furin cleavage site of SARS-2 is not an orthodox furin cleavage site. So it is ultimately composed of RRAR, and that is not a canonical or standard furin cleavage motif. If RARR, basically switching around the two middle amino acids, would be a canonical one, but that isn't what SARS-2 has. And what SARS-2 has hasn't changed for the entirety of the pandemic. So many parts of the virus have changed, but that furin, the core furin cleavage site, has remained entirely unchanged through the whole pandemic. So that's another reason to think that this was not actually added by a human researcher. So you've got all these different signs that that what was added was not added by a person, that it was some kind of evolutionary accident.
So, I mean, the totality of the evidence is showing you that this was what accidentally released from Wuhan Institute of Virology, or what do you think is the bottom line here?
Yeah. So you've got two seemingly contradictory things going on, that on the one hand, you've got a mountain of evidence that the virus was pre-adapted to humans, that it was released, that it escaped in Wuhan, that it was done by the Wuhan Institute of Virology, that and so forth. So like the lab leak, the actual lab leak is super clear, right? It's not proof, but it's, you know, the evidence is really strong. The evidence is also really weak in favor of a zoonosis, right? But then you've got the evidence that the virus actually evolved, that it didn't, it was not a product of cut and paste molecular biology, right? It's not a genetically engineered virus. So to most people, these two sets of indicators are basically utterly confusing and contradictory, right? How can it have leaked from the Wuhan Institute of Virology as a human-adapted virus and not have been genetically engineered, right? That makes no sense. But if you think about the minor hypothesis reconciles these two things. Right, it basically says the virus evolved inside these minors. So the part of the minor theory that I didn't get as far as explaining to you earlier is that these minors, two of them, were in hospital for 5 months. Right, 5 months is a very long time to be harboring a bat coronavirus. Right, we know that these minors were immunosuppressed because they got all these fungal infections and so forth. And what we think happened and what we theorized way back in 2020 is that these miners basically contracted a bat virus in the mine. They then went to the hospital. The hospital kept them basically on life support, but at the same time, they were immunosuppressed. And so that they couldn't clear the virus, but so the virus was able basically to become human adapted inside them. And that was our initial suggestion. And now we know, for example, that the Omicron strain, the Alpha strain, the Beta strain, the Epsilon strain, the Iota strain, a whole host of these recent and long-standing viral variants of SARS-2 that basically swept the globe in succession between late 2020, and today, basically evolved inside single people, right? The whole pandemic is being propagated by infections that occurred inside a single person who had the virus for somewhere between 6 months and 18 months and never could clear it. And essentially what happens is the virus evolves inside a person. They cannot clear it. The virus has a perfect opportunity to learn how to adapt around the immune system. And then when they finally transmit the virus, that becomes a new strain, right? So this is the history of Omicron, for example, that basically, if you look at the biology, it's crystal clear that Omicron appeared in, let me get my facts right. in late 2021. The nearest related virus, Omicron did not arise from viruses that were extant at the time, right? It arose from a virus that hadn't been seen for 6 months, right? What that tells you is that somehow the Omicron virus was being sequestered away in some kind of privileged site where none of its relatives could get out, where it basically was festering away, evolving. And when then suddenly it breaks out and becomes the dominant strain and wipes all the other ones out, right? What this is telling you is that evolution can happen far faster and better and quicker inside a single person than it can happen in the entire rest of the global population, right? Inside a single person, it can evolve quicker than it does inside 6 billion people.
So it seems like a lot of viruses start out being very virulent, and then they adapt. Maybe they go latent in a population or just stop being as virulent. Do you think there's a drive there, maybe on the part of the virus to survive, and that's why the virulence is toned down? There's an adaptation occurring where it's more commensal with its host over time?
It's too early to say, in my opinion. I mean, what's happened with these new strains is that even though they're new strains, they are now breaking out inside a population, the humans, who have immunity, a basic level of immunity to SARS-2. So the most of the reduction in the death toll of people from the virus compared with the early stages, the first 9 months of the pandemic when no one had ever been infected by a SARS-2 type coronavirus, is simply that the population has evolved a basic degree of immunity, right? So disentangling that basic level of immunity from the inherent infectiousness of an inherent pathogenicity of all the new viruses, the Omicrons, the Betas, the Deltas, and so forth, is actually a really difficult task, because you've basically got to measure its pathogenicity inside a controlled population that hasn't been either vaccinated or had prior infections. And those people are rare at this point. So the only other experiment that you can do is, you know, to put these viruses into model organisms, you know, your humanized mouse or your hamsters or macaques or whatever it is. But then it's a virus in a different species, and its pathogenicity is going to be different. And the subtle differences between a Delta and an Omicron and a Beta and a wild type strain are basically lost in many of these organisms. So you can't do the experiment, right? That's the basic problem. So so the bottom line is probably a lot of the reduction in pathogenicity is attributable to herd immunity, basically population level immunity, however acquired. But there's a strong feeling among researchers that the newer variants are less pathogenic. But what we would argue, I mean, based on our minor theory, right, what we think has been happening is that the virus evolved in the lungs of a single miner, right? The surface area, if you imagine how a virus evolves inside a single human person, the virus basically has a free range to go wherever it wants in the respiratory tract. The main surface area in a respiratory tract is the alveoli, right? They're the tennis court size surface through which you exchange oxygen and CO2. So the virus basically is selected to perform well in the deep lungs. But performing well in the deep lungs is not useful for a transmissible virus, right? So what happened at the beginning was we were getting a virus that was adapted to the deep lungs, and that's a very pathogenic virus. Whereas a virus evolves, it becomes more and more adapted to the nose and the throat. So the nose and the throat are the organs, firstly, where the virus first is ingested, and secondly, where the spread happens from. If you give a virus, the source of that virus and the destination of that virus will be your nose and your throat. So the virus is being strongly selected to do well in the nose and the throat And the nose and throat have radically different requirements than the deep lungs. The cell types are different. The receptors are different. The proteases are different. Everything is different.
What does that mean? What does that mean? They're adapted to the nose and throat. They intend to take up permanent residence there, like, or they're, well, they're getting gagged by the immune
system. Your immune system basically purges the virus, right? It's not a virus like HIV that is designed to live in a host for 25 years. This is a virus that's basically a weed, right? This life history strategy is quick in and quick out, right? So what happened, what that mean, evolution in the nose and the throat means, for example, that you replicate very fast, right? So if you replicate very fast, the host starts transmitting the virus within 2 or 3 days of they being first infected. And that what that does is that stops the virus from being challenged by the host immune system. The host immune system takes a week to kick in, right? If the virus can be in and out before that week is finished, then it can basically transmit to the next person and avoid the host immunity completely. If the virus needs to go to the deep lungs, then it's going to be there for a longer amount of time, and it needs a strategy of avoiding the host immune system, right? It becomes a different kind of a virus. So the virus starting out is that kind of a virus, but then it becomes more and more of a quick in, quick out, nose and throat virus, a bit like the common cold. So that's what it's been doing. So for example, the temperature of the nose is like 32 degrees. The temperature of the deep lungs is 37 degrees. So the virus becomes more and more adapted to a lower temperature and less adapted to the high temperature. So there's many ways that the virus can adapt to become a nose and throat virus.
So where do things go from here? You know, you're gathering more and more evidence that the lab leak appears to be, you know, what happened. The particular version that you mentioned of the two, there seems to be no appetite for the truth. So do you feel disheartened?
What we want to do is publish our work. You know, we have opportunities, I think, to publish this in the scientific literature. But obviously, there's a lot of people who do not want that to happen. And so, you know, we'll have a little bit of a challenge to get that done. And we still have not submitted a paper to the scientific literature explaining our theory, and partly because all new information comes along all the time, right? Like only a couple of weeks ago, we found a paper about this mutation called H519, which is a spike mutation. And what this spike mutation does is it is totally conserved in all the bat viruses, the bat wild relatives of SARS-2. What it does is it opens the spike and allows the virus to bind to the receptor better. And what we know about the virus life cycle in the bat is that basically it's a GI tract virus. The GI tract is a place of low pH. There's a lot of proteases. There's a lot of threat to the integrity of the virus and specifically the integrity of the spike. So the virus spends a lot of time with a closed spike. With a closed spike, can't bind to the receptor, right? So when the virus goes to the human lung, the adaptive strategy is to open the spike and allow the virus to bind to the receptor, right? It basically becomes a more receptor-open virus. So what this H519 mutation does is it opens the spike and allows the RBD, the receptor binding domain, to be exposed on the surface of the spike so the virus can replicate quicker, enter cells quicker, do its conduct its whole life history much more rapidly. So this is a mutation that is a clear hallmark of adaptation to outside of a bat, right? Adaptation outside of a bat by a genetic locus about which there are no scientific papers and nobody's ever discussed this as an important feature of adaptiveness of spillovers or a feature of spillovers is a clear indication, an unarguable indication that the pathway of the virus spreading to Wuhan involved evolution. Right. So I was saying to you, the furin cleavage site is a product of evolution. I also think that there are a number of other mutations in the spike that are clear hallmarks of evolution. I think it will be very difficult for people to argue that there's something else, that they're deliberately introduced by a genetic engineer. but that's the only, so evolution becomes the only way to explain that. So if you have, on the one hand, as I was saying earlier, this clear indication that the virus is basically spilled from the Wuhan Institute of Virology, and you've also got a clear indication that it evolved, then you have to think about what are the pathways of evolution of a virus that also spilled from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And one possibility, for example, would be passaging in animals, passaging in mice, humanized mice, passaging in macaques, for example. But those possibilities don't fit the bill too well either, right? There are too many mutations, too many changes that are needed to make that change. The basically passaging of the kind that humans normally do in a lab, researchers do in a lab, is still not a powerful enough strategy to change, to make a bat virus into a human competent virus of the kind that broke out in Wuhan. And then when it broke out in Wuhan, there were basically or practically no changes that happened to the virus for months and months that adapted it to humans. So the standard virus, zoonosis, happens. The first humans become sick, and the virus very rapidly adapts, as SARS-1 did, to the human receptor, to the tissue tropism that's needed. All these different aspects of the virus start to change rapidly inside a new virus. That's not what happened with SARS-2. We only know one mutation that was a change, and it was not even an adaptation. It's just D614G, and it was not an adaptation to humans at all.
Well, very good, Jonathan. So where can people go to learn more about your ongoing investigation? What do you recommend?
Our website is called Independent Science News. That is probably the single best place to go. I mean, I'm hoping that we will publish a paper in the scientific literature, but that may take quite a few months to come out. Twitter, the best discussions of virus origins are on Twitter generally. But we do have, you know, we personally have disagreements with the narrative that is on Twitter. I don't think many of those people are knowledgeable enough virologists to understand all the nuances of the meaning of these mutations. There's a group called Biosafety Now that is very concerned with lab leaks and with all the kind of the biosafety. I mean, they're interested in biosecurity and the safety of labs. You know, how much are we ever going to find out about what happens inside labs, what kind of reporting, what kind of experiments will be allowed, and so forth. And those people are very credible and honest, and they're a good source of useful information too.
Okay. Well, very good, Jonathan. Thank you so much for coming on and speaking about this, this truth, because very few outlets want to cover any of this. So I appreciate you doing it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it too, because I don't get too many chances to be interviewed about this. You know, we used to have a lot of alternative media outlets who would cover our work on pesticides and on GMOs and on problems with industrial agriculture and so forth. But pretty much all of them have avoided the COVID origin issue. So yeah, thank you.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at findinggeniuspodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.